Welcome to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the online moderator for today's session. Today we'll be kicking off the CEC Preliminary Assessment and Site Inspection, or PASI, webinar series with module number 3. Today's focus will be on site evaluation and scoring site sources. We'll be joined by 2 instructors from Tetra Tech, Inc., including Sandra Harrigan and Therese Joya. Before I turn things over to them, let me walk through a few reminder items for our participants today. Again, we're going to run today's webinar just the same way we have with the others in the series. So you should have a unique reminder email for each module in the series, which will have the instructions you need for each one of these webinars. That email is ultimately going to point you to something known as the CLUIN Seminar homepage, where you can read more about the broadcast, find contact information for our instructors, even download copies of the presentation materials. Which you may find particularly helpful. So I encourage you, if you haven't done so yet, to take a moment and download a copy of the presentation materials, again, that are posted off the seminar homepage. Once you've done that, I'd click a button labeled Go to Seminar that appears in the upper left-hand corner, where you'll be asked to identify yourself by name as well as the number of people at your location, and then you'll be successfully checked in online. One note, you do need to enter or check in using the same names you registered with. So if your name is William, but you registered under the name Bill, you'll need to check in with the name Bill. The system won't find you if you use William. Once you've come on board to our fully interactive Adobe Connect environment, you'll be able to watch and listen in real time as our instructors deliver their presentations. We will be using a few interactive features today, which will include live audience polls. So at certain points throughout the webinar, you'll be asked to vote or answer questions electronically, and we'll call attention to those when they pop up. We will also be providing not only real-time presentations, but we'll be doing some live demonstrations of QuickScore. So at various points in the session today, you'll actually be able to watch one of the instructors as they run the QuickScore software. If you have any difficulty in watching that live simulation, we will provide a few tips on some of the best ways to watch that and some other things you can do to try to improve it. I encourage you to get on as high of a speed of internet connection as you can. If you're connected to a VPN for your work, I would disconnect from that VPN unless you need it to remain connected to the internet. Those VPNs can sometimes slow down your internet connection. If you have problems, again, with that live demonstration of the software, we encourage you to refer back to the presentation materials because they do have a number of screenshots that are included in the slide deck that will be helpful. And again, we are going to record today's broadcast, so if you find that the live broadcast isn't working, you'll be able to come back and replay the live demonstration and sort of pause it and replay it as needed. If you have problems joining us online, again, you do have those slides to download, and you can simply call in on the telephone lines. Just know if you join us on the telephone lines, you will be placed on a global mute. If you need the call-in number or have misplaced it, use the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen to request it at any time. Audio will also be available by default online to all participants. That means you'll be able to listen to this entire session right to your computer or mobile device. If you have problems with that, again, we do have toll-free call-in information that we'll be more than happy to share. We do have an interactive Q&A window that appears in the lower right corner. That window will remain up the entire broadcast and is the primary way we'll be collecting questions and comments for our instructors. So I encourage you to type up your questions or comments at any time, as well as to report any technical problems that you might have. Just know your questions are privately submitted. To do that, simply click on the empty box at the bottom of the Q&A window. You should be able to type a question or comment in there. When you're done, either hit enter or press the cartoon-looking bubble button to the right, and that privately submits your question in. We will take designated breaks for Q&A with our instructors, and at that time, I'll read them out loud to you, or out loud to the instructors so that they may answer them. Today's session is being recorded and will automatically be shared via email as soon as we have the archive ready. We have recorded modules 1 and 2 in the series. I do have the links for those modules, so if you missed those sessions or were unable to participate live for the complete modules 1 or 2, just use the Q&A window, and I'll be more than happy to get you the links to play back either one of those recorded modules. You'll also find those, along with nearly 600 archived CLUIN webinars, up on our CLUIN archive page, which you're certainly welcome to browse through and replay as you like. So again, quick reminder, you'll see the slides over here on the left side of your screen. You'll see our CLUIN logo in the upper right corner, a collection of related URLs. These are all active hyperlinks. You can click on them at any time and then press the Browse To button to open them up locally. If you're looking for the seminar slides, you'll find those off the seminar homepage or seminar resources area. And then our interactive Q&A window, which appears here in the lower right. You can click this empty box to submit your comments or questions at any time. Again, this is a 9-part module series. We're here with module number 3. We'll carry on with module number 4 this coming Wednesday. If you haven't registered for all of the modules in the series, you can do so at our CLUIN training calendar at www.cluin.org/live. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders I have for today. I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our instructor, who is Sandra Harrigan from Tetra Tech, Inc. Sandra, whenever you're ready to begin, please feel free.
Okay, thank you, Jean. Okay, so we're on our third module for the PASI webinar series. So we're going to talk about evaluating sites and also scoring our site sources. During this module, we're going to focus on a few things. Basically, the first thing we will try to focus on is scoring the site. What is the scoring process? We will talk about an overall approach to scoring a site during the PA stage or the PA phase, because whenever you do site assessment work, there's several different levels, and based on the level of work that you're currently doing, you may go more and more in-depth with your site assessment work and also the levels of documentation that are required to score your site. We will talk about using the existing analytical data, when it is appropriate to use the data, if you have information that is appropriate to use to score particular elements of the scoring module. And also we'll talk about using our best professional judgment. Because as we go through and we do our site assessment work, we're going to gain experience. And from our experiences from scoring different sites and also our knowledge of particular areas, we will be able to make particular best professional judgments while we're scoring our site and doing our site assessment work. We will also talk about terminology that is specific to the PA, and also we'll talk about the related terms to the HRS, and we will go through the scoring model that we use to score sites at the PA stage, which is the HRS Quick Score software. It is a software that was prepared by EPA and is available for free on the web. I believe that there should be a link to the HRS Quick Score, and we will go through scoring the sources for today. Later on in the modules, we will go through scoring each of the different pathways in the HRS scoring process. Okay, so at the PA stage, we more or less use the HRS, the Hazard Ranking System, as a screening tool. And the reason why we use the HRS as a screening tool at this level is because we often don't have enough information to properly score a site that might be an NPL candidate site to propose that site for the NPL. So we oftentimes have limited information, so we use the limited information that we have along with our best professional judgment, and we make assumptions, and we use the HRS as a screening tool. Because the HRS requires a lot of extensive analytical results, analytical data, to be able to score a site properly, where we can document whether or not a release has occurred, and what type of media and what type of targets or receptors the release will affect. So we will talk about scoring the site at the PA level, and we will talk about when we can make particular assumptions and when it's appropriate to use existing analytical results to score a site. Okay, so one of the key factors that we look at, and one of the first things that we look at when we score a site, is what is the hazardous waste quantity? What sources do we have at the site? How much of the waste do we have? Do we have multiple sources, areas where we've got contamination or hazardous substances are present? Or do we have maybe just one single source where hazardous substances would be present? So at the PA stage, when we calculate our hazardous waste quantity, and our waste, well, a hazardous waste quantity, we generally use that hazardous waste quantity when we look at all the four different pathways. But there are some exceptions that we look at for each particular pathway. For instance, let's say if we have a waste quantity of a 100. When we have a migration pathway like groundwater or surface water, if we can document that we have a target that is actually exposed to contamination, where the contamination is above a particular benchmark, like for instance an MCL, then we may be able to get a higher number of points for our waste quantity. So we will talk about those things as we go through the different pathways in some of the later modules. But the first thing that we usually try to document when we evaluate our site is what is the waste quantity, and in calculating our waste quantity, we look at what sources do we have, what source types do we have, and what is the size of the source. So at this time, we're more or less looking at how much do we have, what is the quantity, and how much of it do we actually have. Okay. So when we score a site, the approach to scoring sites and looking at each particular pathway, we look at the major factor categories in the HRS, which are likelihood of release, targets, and waste characteristics. When we look at likelihood of release, basically we're looking at how likely is it that a hazardous substance from a source location is going to be released into the environment, and will it affect any particular targets or receptors, like wells or fisheries. And when we look at likelihood of release, we look at observed release, which would mean that a release has occurred, or we look at likelihood of exposure for the soil exposure pathway, and we will talk about that later on. Or we look at potential to release. If a release has not occurred, we look at how toxic is the substance, what sources are the hazardous substances located in, and how likely will those hazardous substances be released from the source and into a particular media like surface water or groundwater or onto the soil for soil exposure. We look at targets, and targets would be who or what the release actually affects, and we look at whether or not those targets are actually contaminated, and that would mean that we've got a sample collected at that particular location from a drinking water well or maybe from a fishery, and we can document that, yes, in fact, a release has occurred from my site, from a source at my site, and I know that this particular target location is contaminated. Potential contamination would be, I do have sources associated with my site. They are hazardous substances that have the potential to release, and they are media or there's targets that might possibly be affected. So we would have maybe wells in the area or sensitive environments, wetlands, we may have fisheries. And we look at our waste characteristics. Generally, we use the waste characteristics that we have already calculated, but the waste characteristics varies. The maximum value for the waste characteristics, that varies from pathway to pathway. And as we go through the scoring model and we look at all the different pathways, we're going to see what the maximum values are. We kind of touched on it when we looked at module number 2, which pathways and what the maximum values are. When we look at HRS scoring, our likelihood of release and our waste characteristics have maximum values, but our targets are uncapped. So that would mean that you can have any amount of targets. There's no maximum value for targets. Okay, so basically this is the formula that we use to when we score a site. We have 4 different pathways. We have the groundwater pathway, surface water, soil, and air. And in order to get your site score, we develop the site score for each pathway individually. Then we square each pathway score. Then we sum all 4 pathway scores. Then we divide that number by 4. And then we take the square root of the number that we get. And that is how we develop the overall site score. So first we have to calculate the individual pathway scores, square them, sum them, divide by 4, and then we take the square root. And we will go through a scoring process like I mentioned before. Okay, so, you know, in lots of things that we do, there's always pitfalls. You know, the road is never smoothly paved. There's always, you know, bumps along the way. So it is very important for us to recognize those types of things that may be pitfalls or maybe limiting factors as we go through our scoring for our site. One of the key things that we need to make sure of is sometimes we have existing data. We may have sampling results from different investigations. Even at the PA stage, we might find that results are already available. But sometimes the data that is already collected and has already been collected, it is not compatible with our site assessment goals. So we have to take a look at the information that is available and figure out, can I use this to score my site? Can I use this for site assessment purposes? For example, you may have a project where a removal may have occurred. Samples were collected for waste disposal, but you may be able to use those samples to document whether or not contamination was located in a source or to document that the source is present or was present, but those same types of samples might not be able to be used to document whether or not an observed release occurred. So therefore, the data that is available from that particular sampling event might be able to use for one thing or one part of our scoring process, but it can't be used for a different part. Because oftentimes you may have those samples, they only were looking at waste disposal. And even if there might have been residences close by, they weren't focused on trying to document targets. So therefore, there might have been a well, a drinking water well nearby, but because their focus was different, they did not sample that well. So that is one key thing that we have to pay attention to, that we have results available, but we can't really use it. Sometimes the information might be there. There might be samples collected from different media, groundwater samples, soil samples, surface water samples, but it's not adequate. Maybe it's not collected at a target location. So let's say we've got three wells in the area, and we sampled the closest well, but it turns out that well is not used for drinking water. So now we've got a groundwater sample, but it's not at a target location. So we may be able to document an observed release to groundwater with that sample from the well, but we can't use it for targets. So depending on the information that we have, we might not be able to use it for particular factors, scoring factors in the HRS model. Or we might have a situation where the laboratory quality, the data quality is unknown. So whenever we score a site, the results have to be of known quality. We have to know what are the laboratory analytical methods, what are the detection limits. We also need to know whether or not the data has been validated by a third party. So those types of things are key, because we want to make sure when we're using the results, analytical results, to score a site, it's of known quality, and we know it's good, sound data. So if we are using results that has not been validated, then, you know, we're not sure if the releases that we're saying might be a release, if that is actually true. Because sometimes we may have estimated results, and maybe it's estimated high, so we might not be able to use it for those particular purposes. So we oftentimes would have results available, but we need to know what is the quality of that data. Can we use it for the purpose that we're trying to use it for? Also, as we're scoring a site, we need to think about whether or not the site conditions have changed since that sampling event occurred. One key factor this usually affects would be targets. Sometimes we have sampling results, but there was not enough targets, or there were no targets in that particular locale at the time. As the population increased in particular areas, especially rural areas, you may have targets that are moving into that area. So therefore, the results that you had back then might not be sufficient, because now you have all of these targets, so you may need to go back and reevaluate and determine, oh, I might need to do some more sampling so I can evaluate whether or not those targets may be affected by a release or potential to release from my site. Another key thing that we need to think about as far as analytical results would be, how old is the data? Generally, when we use results, we try to use data that is less than 5 years old to document observed releases and also for targets. So if, for instance, you have results that might be, you know, historical information documenting the type of contamination that might be in the source, we can probably use that to characterize the source along with some current information. But using data that is very old to be able to score your site for observed release, that might not be a very good idea. Okay, So more on the appropriateness of using existing analytical results. So we want to make sure that the data that we have, it can support a release. You know, is it definitive? Can we definitely demonstrate that a release has occurred? Another key thing that we need to think about is whether or not, if we're saying that there's no release or no targets exposed, because at the PA level, we don't have a lot of information. Usually we don't have a lot of information. So during that stage, we want to be as conservative as possible. We want to make sure that we're not, say, like underestimating what our targets might be or underestimating the possibility that a release has occurred. So at the PA level, if we're going to make an assumption that, you know what, a release has not occurred, or you know what, there are no targets exposed to any particular releases or potential to release. If a release was to occur from this side, there are no targets that would be affected. Because we're trying to say no targets would be exposed, we want to make sure that we've got proper documentation for that. Because we don't want to just write this side off when there is a possibility that a release may have actually occurred. And any assumptions that we make at the stage of the PA, when we move on to our SI, if an SI is warranted, then we will test those assumptions, we will test those hypotheses to figure out, okay, did a release actually happen? We're going to sample the media, we're going to see exactly what is there so we can have a better idea of what is going on at the particular site. Okay, so using our best professional judgment, like I mentioned before, sometimes when we evaluate a site, we have to use our professional judgment. It might be a situation where we've got like four or five sites and maybe a small neighborhood in Miami, Florida or something, or it might be a pretty rural area and you're very familiar with that locale. It might be a situation, well, you know what, I used to live in that town many years ago. You may have specific knowledge about a particular area, or you may have done a lot of work in a particular location. It can be even information such as, you know, the geology of the area, because sometimes just knowing what the geology is, you know whether or not it's karst, or you know what type of aquifers might be present, all that information helps when we're scoring our site, so we can try to determine what types of events would occur based on the sources that are there. Is it realistic that a release is going to happen? Can we say, okay, I'm going to assume that because this area is karst and there are, you know, drinking water wells nearby, it is very likely that these wells would be affected by a release at this site. So we use all the information that we have available to us, and we use our professional experience to help us evaluate the site that we're evaluating. And as whenever we use best professional judgment, we want to make sure we document those things. In that way, as we move through the site assessment model, then we're going to make sure that we test out those assumptions that we make. We want to prove or disprove those assumptions. Are they really, was it a valid assumption, or maybe did I stretch a little bit too far? So it's always good to document what assumptions that we're making when we don't have definitive data. Okay, so we use our best professional judgment to hypothesize, you know, about our pathways. What pathways are of concern? So if you have, say, for instance, you've got a surface impoundment, you've got a lagoon, and there appears to be a breach from the lagoon, there's a stream nearby, it's maybe about 50 to 100 feet nearby, then we can hypothesize that, you know what, it's possible that a release from this impoundment would impact my surface water. Or if you have drinking water wells that are, you know, just outside of your site boundary, to say, okay, this is where my site is located, and just within a quarter mile or maybe one-eighth of a mile, I have drinking water wells in the area. So you can probably hypothesize to say, well, you know what, I think the groundwater pathway would be of concern because there are people using groundwater wells for drinking water. We also hypothesize on what targets would be exposed. So if we know we have groundwater wells in the vicinity, then we can assume that, yes, you know, we can assume that drinking water wells would be a target that we would need to focus our sampling efforts on. And the next bullet is very key, where we don't want to underestimate our potential threat from our side, because we want to always make sure when we're doing threat assessment work in this early stage, we want to be as conservative as possible, and we want to err on the side of the conservative side. So if, for instance, there are nearby wells, then we might want to say, you know what, these wells might be affected. So next, when I go back and I do additional work, I'm going to sample those wells. When I'm going to say, you know what, we don't have any documentation saying that a release occurred from this site, so no, those wells are not contaminated. Those wells are not of concern. We want to say, you know what, the wells are very close to the site, and yes, they are of concern. We need to take a second look. Because at this stage, we don't want to name-wrap a site or, like, say, close a site prematurely. We want to make sure that when a site is closed, that we've evaluated that site, we've looked at all of the pathways, we've looked at what potential releases might occur, what targets would be exposed, and when that site is closed, we're confident, yes, I did make the right decision in closing this site. But we don't want to have any, unsettled issues where we did not try to investigate a particular target or determine whether or not a release may have occurred to a particular pathway. So it's always good to, be conservative when we're looking at a site at the PA level, because generally the PA level is the first investigation that we're doing at a site, where we're looking at all the pathways and we're trying to figure out should it go on to the next stage, which would be the SI. Okay. When we talk about PA terms and HRS terms, they're more or less the same thing. You know, they're very similar. We look at the four pathways, groundwater, surface water, soil exposure, and we also look at the air pathway. We look at the same types of factor categories to evaluate those four pathways. What is the likelihood of release, whether we have observed a potential to release. We always look at targets. We need to look at what's the waste characteristic of the hazardous substances. Are they very toxic? Are they very persistent? Do they bioaccumulation in tissues? And so basically, at the PA stage, we're going to find that the terminology is very, very similar. But there are some terms that are a little bit different, and that is in the PA guidance. Since we started using the PA guidance, a lot of things have changed, where we try to make as many of those terms align more with the HRS process. And because, we use the HRS, like I mentioned, as a screening tool to be able to figure out whether or not a site is going to go on to the next stage. So we're going to go ahead and do this participant poll, and then we will talk a little bit more about what the different terms might be in the PA guidance, because whenever I do my site assessment work, there are particular guidance documents that we always refer to. So as you refer to your PA guidance document, you may see terms in there, and we just want to make sure that when you see terms that are a little bit different, that you know that these same terms mean, what terms that they align with in the HRS rule. Okay, for this participant poll, the question asks, at what stage is a preliminary HRS score first prepared? So if you would take a few minutes and answer the poll, and then after most of you guys have already gotten a chance to answer the question, then we will go ahead and reveal what the answer is. So basically, when we're doing our site assessment work, do we generally prepare a preliminary HRS score? That's not a score for an HRS package, but at what point do we generally do our first preliminary score? Is it at the site inspection stage, a site reassessment, a preliminary assessment, or would it be when you're putting together your documentation record for the NPL? And Jean, you will let me know when you see a good bit of participants have answered the question.
Okay, well, it looks like we are getting more and more votes. Again, to vote on those poll, it's in the lower left half of your screen. If you're having problems voting because you're using a mobile device and you can't vote on that poll, you can simply type an answer into the Q&A window in the lower right corner on a mobile device. But if you can see the poll, and you can, simply click the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply, and that's all you need to do to submit your votes.
Okay.
It looks like we've got most of the audience. Let's see, you voted, and yes for the participant. Yes, we can see that you voted for the participant who just asked. Why don't we go ahead and let's talk about what the correct answer is at this point.
Okay. So basically, when we prepare a preliminary HRS score for a site, we generally do that at the preliminary assessment stage or the PA stage. Because at the PA stage, we're trying to develop our site information to figure out what are the pathways of concern, what targets might be affected. We use our best professional judgment and what information that we have, what existing information, historical information, we use current information, all that we use it as part of our screening process, and we develop a preliminary score at the PA stage. So the correct answer is preliminary assessment. So you guys did a great job on that. Okay, so we're going to go back to the M slide. So the terms that are, for the PA terms that you will see in the site, in the PA guidance document, you will see like a suspected release. In the HRS, that would be like an observed release. You will see no suspected release, which is the same thing as potential to release. And we will see primary targets and secondary targets. So primary targets would be when we have actual contamination at level 1 and level 2 concentrations. We will talk about level 1 and level 2 concentrations later on. And that's basically whether or not we've got a sample at a target location and whether or not the concentration in that sample has exceeded an HRS benchmark like an MCL in a drinking water well. And the secondary targets would be what targets or receptors are within the target distance limit. We will talk about the target distance limit for each pathway as we go through each pathway, and we look at what potential targets that we have in the area within our target distance limit that might possibly be affected by a release or potential release from the site. Okay, so defining our site sources. In order for us to define our site source, we need to look at what is our site background. What information do we have that is readily available that we can review to help determine what our site is all about? What sources are present? What targets might possibly be affected? We would look through, we would need to do a file search. Maybe we may do a file search at a state office. There might be information from the facility itself that tells us information about what types of activities they may have conducted on the property. We may look at things like permits and manifests to get all the background information that we need to be able to evaluate our site. So we also will identify what sources there are at the site, and we will talk about source types. So not only do we have sources, but we have source types as well. And as we go through the scoring of the site sources, you will see how we can have the site, the source is called one thing, but we have to pick a specific source type which is in the HRS rule. We will talk about our hazardous waste quantity, figuring out how much of waste do we have in the different sources and how we determine what the waste quantity is. We will identify hazardous substances that are associated with the source based on the file information that we will have, and also we will think about what pathways are of concern at the site that we're evaluating. And at the end of the module, we will go through the quick score to develop a preliminary HRS score. At this stage for this module, we will only be looking at the sources. We won't look at the pathways at this time, only the sources. Okay, so site definition. So basically, your site definition would be, you know, any area or areas where hazardous substances have been deposited, stored, disposed of, placed, or otherwise come to be located. So your site will include maybe a single source or multiple sources, and it also includes the areas in between those sources. We can use historical information as well as current information to help define what our site is, to gather information about those sources, the hazardous substances that are present, and also what types of targets those sources will end up affecting. When we look at our site boundary, we look at the sources more or less, and we disregard property boundaries and fences, those types of things. Or on module number 2, we had a question about two different sites where someone asked, what if you have, say, site A and site B, the contamination originated at site A, and now it's been documented at site B. So those two properties are owned by different people. So when we look at our site, it's going to include both of those properties. And we will go through and we will look at an example of how we would define that. Okay, so this is an example of trying to define the site. So on this diagram, we've got current lagoons. You know, we show the site boundary as the bright pink line. And we also show, you know, current lagoons. We show former lagoons. You know, there are houses nearby. And there's also an area of contaminated soil. So when we talked about the site definition, we talked about locations where waste have been stored, deposited, disposed of, or placed, and where it has come to be located. So in this case, we're not going to define our site simply by the boundary, which is the pink line, but we're going to extend it to the red line because we showed that, you know what, maybe we looked on some historical aerial photographs and we're seeing, there were lagoons over in this area just, you know, to the northeast side of the site. And now we've got contaminated soil all in this area. So we have to include that contaminated soil as part of our source. So if this is a residence right here and someone lives there, now these people are going to be targets that we'll want to look at. Maybe they might have a well. So when we collect samples, we're going to want to collect samples from their well if they have a well that they use for drinking water. So in a case like this, our site includes the entire area, including the pink and the red areas. The whole thing will include our site boundary. So this is a perfect example that shows that your site is not just defined by the physical boundary or the area that is owned by, say, ABC Inc. facility. Okay, so source definition. So basically the source would be that particular location where waste was stored, deposited, or disposed of. And when we look at our sources, we also look at soil that might be contaminated based on migration. Like we saw in the previous slide, then maybe the contaminated soil resulted from those two areas where we had lagoons, and maybe there was some sort of relief, and now the soil is contaminated. So we will include not only those impoundments or the lagoons as sources, but we would also include the contaminated soil as sources. Sometimes we have information in a file that tells us, you know what, there used to be an impoundment or a landfill, and they excavated it. So even if that was supposedly a former source, we can still look at that and evaluate it, because if we were to collect samples, we will determine whether or not the threat still remains, whether or not there's contamination still in that area. Because back in the day, a lot of times when removals may have occurred, maybe the facility stopped using this waste disposal area 1, they moved to waste disposal area 2. They may have done an excavation at waste disposal area 1, but it was not adequate to take away the threat of a release into groundwater or so. So we always look at present sources, and we also look at our former sources. We want to look at the hazardous substances. What hazardous substances are present in those particular sources? We want to always figure out, are they toxic? You know, are they mobile? How persistent are they? Can they accumulate in fish tissue? So those are the types of things that we want to try to determine about the hazardous substances that are present at the site. And those things we will use in our scoring of our site. So now we're going to talk about the types of sources. So the HRS defines several different types of sources, And it has a definition section at the very beginning of the rule, and there should be a link to the HRS rule on the in the resources section, and it's also in the HRS toolbox. So basically, you've got landfills, you know, you've got impoundments, you've got drums. There's several different types of sources. When we look at a particular source, we need to figure out, based on the file information that we have, does it really and truly meet that definition? For example, in our old file information, we might have information about the dump. So, you know, we use dump and landfills a lot of times, you know, as synonyms. You know, they mean the same thing. But when we're going to evaluate a source as a landfill for HRS purposes, we need to find out whether or not it actually meets the definition. So it basically has to be an engineered or a natural area, natural hole or ground, in the ground, where waste have been deposited by backfilling, and waste have been, soil has been deposited on top of that waste to cover it. So basically, in the term that I like to use is cover and fill and cover. So you dump the waste into the depression or in the engineered structure, and you cover it. So oftentimes, we need to document that the landfill has a daily cover. They're putting some sort of soil on top of it to ensure that the waste is covered and it's not exposed. Okay, so surface impoundments. So surface impoundments are usually some sort of topographic depression, and it can be where there's a dike or something like that, where maybe someone formed a depression, they dug a hole in the ground, it was a man-made depression, and they diked it to be able to contain the waste. The key thing that we have to remember about surface impoundments is that it has to be formed of earth materials, and it has to have been constructed to contain liquid waste or sludge. So those are the key things that we have to remember about surface impoundments. Drums and other types of containers. So basically, when you think about drums and other types of containers, it just basically tells us the waste has to be containerized in some sort of structure that is, you know, all closed up. So we know what drums are. So containers can be whether or not they're above ground tanks, underground storage tanks. So you may have various types of containers. You may have different pails, 5-gallon buckets that might have waste in them. And we also look at piles. There are several different types of piles, whether you've got a tailings pile, trash pile, chemical pile. So basically, a pile would be where you've got a surface area where the pile is on top of the surface, on top of the ground, and it's mounded. So generally, when you have a pile, you always have something that is mounded above the ground surface, but it's covering some amount of surface area on the ground. Okay, so those are some pictures. We will just flip through some of the pictures so we can move on to the quick score scoring part. So this shows you about what landfills generally look like. And surface impoundment, this one looks really gross. You can see that it's an excavation into the ground, and there's dirt all around it. And it has the key thing, it has liquid waste inside of it. Okay. So this shows you the various types of drums and containers that might store waste that we would need to look out for as we go to our different sites, and, you know, trash piles, chemical piles. So all of these are different types of sources that we can look at and evaluate using the HRS rule and as we score our HRS, our sites using the HRS. Okay, landforms. Lots of times we don't have landforms. They are not as common. But every now and then, you might just get lucky and you might have a landform at your site. A landform is basically a waste management area where liquid waste is spread, or sludge might be spread over a particular area, and it is tilled or it is spread over the area so it can evaporate and dry. And it's usually right onto the soil. Sometimes you have the liquid waste might be injected into the shallow subsurface, so it can spread out and dry. And usually when you have a landform area, they will repeat that process. It will be allowed to dry for some period of time, and then another set of more liquid will be spread onto the area, or sludge will be spread onto the area and allowed to evaporate and dry, the liquid evaporate and dry again. So that's what a landform is. Okay, so contaminated soil, basically that's where we have contamination within the top 2 feet of the surface. That is one thing that we need. Well, I'm sorry. That is for the soil exposure pathway. Contaminated soil can be several different seeds. It can be, you know, any depth below the surface. But when we're looking at soil exposure, it's only in the top 2 feet. Okay. And there's various other types of sources that are all piled in one category, and we call it other. And all of those are the types of sources that don't fit neatly into one of the HRS terms that we talked about as far as landfills, landforms, drums, surface impoundments. Those can be things like storm drains, contaminated buildings. There's several different kinds. The two most common kinds are groundwater plumes and contaminated sediments. And when we look at sources, because groundwater plumes and contaminated sediments are the two most common ones, we wanted to bring this slide up and show you where if you have air, groundwater, and surface water or sediment, where those types of media, they became contaminated because of contamination that was released from a source, we usually don't include those as sources because they document where a release occurred. But in some cases, we have a situation where there's no identified source, and that's more common for groundwater plumes and also contaminated sediments. So if you have a groundwater plume with no identifiable source or sediment with no identifiable source, then we can use those two as a source, and the source type, the HRS source type, will be other. So those are the two most common source types, other, that we tend to use as we score sites using the HRS. Sometimes you have a groundwater plume where there are so many different sources of contamination in your area that the way the releases are all commingled and you cannot separate one from the other. So in a case like that, you can also use a groundwater plume as your source. Okay, so basically sources and waste data. So as we evaluate a site, we want to ask ourselves several questions. You know, do our sources contain waste? They have to contain waste if we are going to evaluate as a source, because if it doesn't contain waste, it's not really a source. Whether or not a leak has occurred from that source, have waste leaked or flowed out, where did the contents go? Did it migrate to groundwater? Was it discharged into surface water? Is it now on someone's property and is it in a shallow soil? We want to ask how much of the waste do we have? What kinds of waste do we have? And what is the physical state of the waste? Because we need to think about the physical state, whether or not it's liquid, solid, or gas, because as we go through our different pathways, we will see how the physical state of the waste make a difference in the scoring factors that we assigned in our HRS scoring model. So those are some key questions that we need to ask ourselves as we go through our screening of our site at the PA stage using the HRS as that screening tool. Okay, so data resources. At the PA stage, you know, we're just gathering a bunch of information. We're trying to figure out what information is out there, because this, a lot of times, is the very first time that we're evaluating a site. So you want to figure out what types of investigations have been conducted. Have there been any types of enforcement action, you know, conducted at the site? Sometimes we go through our file and there's like a notice of violation. You know, there might be manifest there that might talk about, oh, they manifested X amount of drums that contain TCE or PCBs or some sort of waste or some sort of waste stream, and it was disposed of at X particular landfill or something like that. So we look at all the information that is existing about the site so we can gather information about the site to help us to define what that site is all about. We may use aerial photography because you might have a situation where maybe the area is all different. It looks so different that you might be able to use a historical aerial photograph that might show you where an impoundment might have been, say, 20 or 30 years ago. Because an old report might talk about waste being disposed of in an impoundment, but then if you were to get an aerial photograph of that time frame, you might see exactly where it is. So when you're doing your sampling, then you can, you know, place your samples in an area to be able to characterize that particular source. Okay, another area in which we obtain information is during our site recon. You know, first-hand observations are the best kind. When you go out to your site, we want to make sure we document, you know, where the source is. Can we document how large they are? Maybe we might not be able to come up with exact dimensions, but we can at least try to estimate what those dimensions are. Are our sources contained? Do they have some sort of engineered structure, something that prevents the waste from being able to be released from the source area into the environment? You may have tanks. Is it inside of secondary containment? Does the service empowerment have proper freeboard so liquids won't be disposed of? You know, do you have a landfill? Does the file information talk about whether or not there's a liner, beneath the landfill? So those types of things tell us whether or not the waste inside of our sources, whether or not they're contained. And we need to also document evidence of waste migration. So like I talked about, if you have an impoundment at your site and maybe you might notice some sort of discolored soil, you know, you might see a little trailing area where there's dark soil and it's going down to a nearby creek. That shows us that there is some sort of evidence that a release may have occurred from our source area. Okay. So when we look at our sources, we're looking at our waste quantity. And for our waste quantity, there are different ways in which we document the waste quantity. There are four tiers in the HRS rule. We look at tiers A, B, C, and D. So tier A is the highest tier, which is constituent, and that is where we know exactly what is in that particular waste. We know exactly how much TCE that might be present. You know, the actual concentrations of the hazardous substances and how much of each one that you have. Waste stream deals with if you have a mixture of waste and you also have some sort of chemical that is in a liquid or something like that. So you would need to know how much of that hazardous substance that you have as well as what is the volume, how much of that mixture I actually have. And volume deals with, you know, whether or not you've got some kind of containerized source like drums and tanks, or if you have an impoundment and you know how deep it is, you know the area of it. So it basically looks at, you know, the volume, how much liquid or so can it hold, and the area, what is the surface area of contamination at your site, of your source. So tier A is very hard to document. At the pH stage, we generally don't have information for tiers A and B, but a lot of times at the pH stage, we have information for tiers C and D. And like I said, volume is the most, volume and area are the two most common ones. That's where we usually have most of the information available. Okay, so we're going to go on to looking at how we would use the HRS to as a screening tool and how we would use the software that we talked about, the HRS Quick Score, to be able to score a site at the PA level. And Therese is
Sandra, just wanted to give you guys a real quick time check. We're about 53 minutes into today's session. Thanks.
Okay. So, Therese, do you want to take some questions now before we move into quick score?
Sure. Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Okay.
Okay. We did have two questions that came in. It looks like you guys answered them, but I'm going to ask them out loud just to reinforce the concepts in case some other participants missed the answer to them. Our first question asked, do drainage wells qualify as a source, or would that be specific to the UIC, the Underground Injection Control Program?
Okay. So if you have an underground injection program and you have drainage wells that are associated with it, I would say that it's part of in that particular system and it's not the actual source. Sometimes you have a situation where you don't really know exactly where that contamination is coming from. And if you have, it's a big old property that you have, abandoned property, and there's some sort of injection well, there are some cases where you can possibly use that as your source, as source type other. But whenever we do HRS work, we always want to try to figure out, can I identify where the contamination came from? Can I identify what source it came from before I tried to use a source type other or one of the other unconventional or non-sources.
Okay. And then our next question asks, can orphan contaminated sediments in surface water be considered a source or waste?
Orphan contaminated sediments? I'm not sure exactly what is meant by orphan contaminated sediments, but what I would imagine...
I would think, Sandra, they mean, you know, sediment contamination without a known source.
Yes, that's what I was thinking as well. So basically, yes, the answer would be yes, where if you have samples collected and you know that there's contaminated sediments and you're not sure where it came from, where the contamination came from, then yes, you can use the contaminated sediments as a source, and the HRS source type would be other.
And usually you're required to do quite a extensive search for sources of that sediment contamination before you can just opt into to using the sediment, the contaminated
yeah.
sediment as the source itself.
Okay, so again, I think we're going to close out with the questions. I don't see any more in the Q&A, but as a reminder to participants, you can continue to submit your questions and comments using the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen.
Okay, so I think it's time to take a look at the Quick Score program. And Jean, I'm not sure if we should just do sharing the screen alone without the slides, because I'm sort of working from the slides, and we have slides intermixed with the Quick Score screenshot. So I don't know what you think. I thought we said we were just going to screen share alone, but I'm not sure that's the way to go.
Okay, well,
Is that too much of a kink in the works?
No, we can do it. I was prepared for this. I was prepared for all curses. So, Sandra, whenever you're ready, in the upper box, you can go ahead and try to share your screen with the QuickScore software.
Okay.
And as Sandra is doing this, let me just kind of explain to our participants what's happening. The left side of your screen that previously just had the PowerPoint slides loaded is now been split into two windows. Sandra, we can see your browser, so feel free to bring up the QuickScore software. In the upper left half of the screen, we have Sandra, who's actually running the QuickScore software. So you'll be able to watch and follow along in real time as she actually clicks through the software component and demonstrates its use. And then in the lower left half, we're continuing on with the PowerPoint slides. We do have related screenshots and some embedded notes. So Therese is going to walk you through the slides, but you'll also be able to watch as Sandra clicks through some things in real time. You each have the ability to decide which window you want to look at, or if you want to look at both windows. And you can expand either one back and forth as needed. So if you prefer to just look at her screen share on the top, there's a button where each participant can choose to enlarge that window. If you look along the gray bar along the top where it says live screen share, it says dash Sandra Harrigan. If you look all the way to the far right of that gray bar, there should be a button that has four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that four-arrowed button, it will actually expand Sandra's screen share and make it larger. If you click that same button again, shrink it back down to its split screen view. You can do almost exactly the same thing to the Module 3 slides, which appear in the lower left half. You should see that very same four-arrowed icon in the upper right of the Module 3 slides window. Click the four arrows once, it'll make the slides bigger. Click the four arrows again, it'll shrink the slides back down. So you all can control and go back and forth and decide what to look at in what order, how big, how small, and that ability will also be preserved in the recording. Okay, so Sandra, we can see your screen, and Jody, we can see your slides. So ladies, please go ahead.
All right, perfect. So what you see here is the very first page of the QuickScore program. When you open it up, this is what you get. And, you know, you can see that we're working from version 3.0.5, and I'm going to just move on because I think I can talk about these things as we go. So I'm going to go to the next slide. Sandra doesn't need to put in any information yet. So if you've worked with QuickScore in the past, it used to look a lot different, and it used to perform a lot different. Its look has been improved, and so has its performance. It used to have a lot of little bugs that were very annoying, even though we continued to use it because it was is a really good program. But they've worked many of those bugs out, and so it's really a nice tool to use. We want to stress to you, though, that it doesn't substitute for an understanding of HRS and the site assessment process. You can't become an HRS expert because you know QuickScore. It really is the opposite. You should improve your knowledge of HRS and the site assessment process and how it works, and that will allow you to use QuickScore like the tool that it was meant to be used as. So it is a consolidated software platform. And it has EPA has increased its functionality as they have improved the QuickScore program. For those of you who have been around a long time like me, you'll remember there were several other software programs that EPA used to use long time ago. One was called PAScore. If you know that one, you're quite old. And then they switched to PreScore. And now they are using QuickScore. So EPA has always tried to develop tools to improve the process, and QuickScore is the most recent version for HRS. We feel it has a very close adherence to the structure of HRS, which makes it nice. When you learn about HRS and you open the QuickScore program, it should look very familiar to you. It's really easy to navigate between sites, and then within a site between sources and pathways and the various data entry screen. It incorporates the updated Superfund chemical data matrix values, and they are new for version 3.05. It does new things in this version, like calculating your level 1, level 2, and potential target values. It used to not do that. You would have to calculate and insert those values yourself. It also does more in the calculation of the waste characteristics and hazardous waste quantity values. I'll go on to the next slide. So it has a lot of tabs and buttons and drop-down menus that are very easy to use. And it also has a link into the HRS rule. So as you're in the QuickScore program and you have a question in your mind about, well, what does the HRS say, you can click on a link, and we'll show you how to do that, and go directly right to the rule. And in some cases, it's very easy because it takes you to the table that you're interested in. In other cases, it takes you to the section of the HRS rule that you might be interested in. And when it takes you to the section and doesn't land you in the right spot, I think it'll be difficult personally to use because you have to scroll to find where you are. So I always like to have a hard copy of the rule with me because I find it's easier to page through than to scroll, but that's really a personal preference. Information is saved as you enter it into the program, and there are numbered steps to actually guide you through the process of scoring all of the elements that you need to pass. If you make corrections or changes in one part of the program, those corrections transfer to all the appropriate screens for that particular site that you're working on. And the real advantage for QuickScore is that you can run multiple scenarios. And this is really valuable at the PA stage. You can run multiple scenarios or hypotheses to see, you know, if your site inspection gave you a certain type of information, what would the resulting pathway or score be? And that's a really valuable thing for planning your site inspection. In addition, you can print out the HRS score sheets, and they can be used in HRS scoring packages. Okay, so now we're going to take a look at what it looks like when you actually decide you're going to create a site. So if you click the Create New Site tab, it opens up a new window, and is in that window right now. But a few of the other features is you have some of these quick command quick commands at the top, like print and export. You will always be able to tell what sites you've been working on because they land in this box here, and you can go back and edit those as necessary. If you get stuck with, you know, the QuickScore program itself, you have a help button here, and you can get help from the program itself, or they have a phone number that you can call here to get technical support for your questions of QuickScore program. All right. So the process we're going to use is to take a look at our fictitious site information, which is the ABC vacuum site, and we are going to complete that the site characterization information or the source information in our QuickScore program. All right, so Sandra has now clicked that Create a New Site button, and she has already entered a lot of the ABC vacuum site information in here, but you can see that only two things you absolutely need, we don't recommend you just put these two, but the two things you absolutely need will have red asterisks next to them. And in this case, it's only the site name and the scenario name. But we think all the other information is valuable so that you can keep track of what you've been doing in the software program and of your sites and your scenarios. So right now you can see Sandra is inputting information, describing the scenario, putting in the EPA and state ID number and location information. All of that was taken from the PA level information that we had available. She's also going to put in the latitude and longitude, which we have available. She'll also talk about what the purpose is of scoring this site. And that's always useful sort of as a historical documentation. If you start scoring a bunch of sites, you'll want to keep them all straight. So in this one, she's going to note that it's PA. This is for a PA. That's really important to know because the certainty you have with the numbers in a PA score will be a lot less than the certainty you have with the numbers that you put in from site inspection or expanded site inspection information. And then we're going to save that. Oh, she's putting in the date, which is today's date, the date that we're actually going to run the scenario. And then she's going to save that. And once you save it, you see that it goes down below to the row. So Sandra has been working on a bunch of different things, but right now we are in the ABC vacuum scoring. All right. One feature I'd also like to talk about is the scratch pad. So it has the scratch pad feature, and you can see Sandra clicked it, and it's also on the next slide. But this is a really nice feature of QuickScore, in my opinion, especially at the PA level, because here you can jot down all the notes about what you're certain about, what you're uncertain about, what other scenarios you think you might like to run in order to help you figure out what's going on at the site and how best to pursue the site inspection to collect the information that will give you the biggest bang for the buck. So with today's resources, we want to make sure that you don't just chase information that really don't do anything for you in terms of the site score. And QuickScore is a really good tool to use to plan that, and the scratch pad is a good to put all of your thoughts about what that strategy should be. In addition, you can sort of organize your references here and start organizing them with the little documentation box. All right. So we need to talk a little bit more about ABC vacuum before we can jump into scoring it. I got to catch up with myself here just one second. All right, so this is the site layout, the site map that we have of ABC vacuum. And you can see that we have six sources associated with this. And we're going to talk about the sources in the order that we're going to input them into QuickScore. So the first source that we're going to address in QuickScore are these drums here. So the PA noted that there were 200 drums. You don't have to do that yet, Sandra. And then the tanks were noted. We have a lagoon, which is still contains liquids. We have an oxidation pond that still contains liquids. We have this rubbish pile. And then we have these three areas of stained soil. So those are our six sources. And you can see where they're located at the site. The other thing of note is that we do have five private residences that are located fairly close to the site, adjacent to it. This little blue feature is a drainage ditch, and you can see where the drainage ditch runs. It sort of drains the property. All right, so we know, based on the PA information, that we have 255 drums. We have two 1,000-gallon mixing tanks. We have a lagoon that's been measured as 3,000 square feet, an oxidation pond that's been measured as 750 square feet, a rubbish pile at 500 square feet, and our three contaminated soil areas total about 1,000 square feet. These are the types of hazardous substances associated with ABC vacuum type sites. We have fairly limited information on the actual chemicals at the site, but in doing research on the types of contaminants associated with these sites, we find these particular contaminants. I'd like to show you, we just didn't make it up. We do have excerpts from the PA reconnaissance. So this was notes taken during the site reconnaissance. And you can see, starting from the entry at 0850 down through the entry at 0955, they're discussing all six of the sources and providing their measurements. So this would be a source of documentation and reference for you if the site did go forward. All right, so now we are ready to start adding our sources into QuickScore. So to do that, you would click the Source Information tab. And when we add our sources to QuickScore, it is going to we're going to have to estimate the sorts of hazardous substances associated with sources in the site. And then what the program does, it's going to calculate our hazardous waste quantity value. And that HWQ value is then used by the program in all of the pathways in all of the migration pathways to calculate the waste characteristic score. And then the soil exposure pathway uses AOCs, and I'll show you how our sources become also AOCs. So Sandra is going to enter our first source, which is the drums. So she types the word drums into that box, and then she selects drums from the source type information. And when she did that, you can see the information in step two changed. And it changed to reflect that we're looking at drums. Now, we don't have enough information to evaluate tier A or tier B, because we only have PA level information. So we are really left with only being able to evaluate the volume, tier C. So, and you can see the units we need is gallons. So if you click on table 2-5, that will take you to table 2-5 of the HRS rule. And there you can see the divisors that are used and the footnotes that are associated. And you can see we have drums, and we have a footnote associated with drums. It's really important to read all the footnotes in the HRS rule. And so for this footnote, it says, if the volume of the drums is unavailable, then you can assume that one drum equals 50 gallons. So for this case, we just decided we would go ahead and use 50 gallons. It wouldn't be wrong to say, I know, they're all 55-gallon drums, and use 55 ed, but we used 50. So we did the math, and we did 50 times 200. That equals 10,000. And we put that 10,000 into box under Tier C volume, and then you hit calculate. And when that happens, you will see the drums appear right there where Sandra is pointing. Sorry, Sandra. You will see what the HWQ is. And then down at the bottom of the row, you will see it's now added your drums as a source. Now, you know, Sandra, I just noticed this because I always like to check the math because I know that QuickScore does have a few bugs. I always like to check the math. So I went back and looked at Table 2-5, saw what it says the divisor is, and if you look there, it says the divisor is 2.5. Well, in my world, 10,000 divided by 2.5 is not 20. And it turns out that's a typo. I don't know why I didn't notice it before. That should actually be 500. So the divisor for drums is 500. The program is using the correct divisor. Now put 10,000 there. Go ahead and put 10,000 there, Sandra. So the program is using the right divisor, but it has a typo in that table. So the appropriate divisor for drums is 500. And I just saw this morning because I decided to check the math. All right, so we're going to move on to step 3. I'm going to catch up with you here, Sandra. All right, so in step 3, you're telling the program what migration pathways you are going to associate the source with. And for this case, we're going to associate them with all of the migration pathways. So Sandra is going to click all three of those boxes, and then we are going to move on to step 4. Now, step 4 is a little more complicated because it requires you to enter contaminant information. And for our ABC vacuum site, we have a lot of contaminants. So in order to do that, you would click the Skidum button there in step 4, and it'll bring up a new window. And is it not coming? It should look like this. Is not cooperating. I'll keep going though. It looks like this. This comes up, and what you'll be doing in this window is you will be one by one. You will be selecting a hazardous substance. You will decide if you're going to associate that hazardous substance with a source or with the site as a whole. All right, so here is our list of hazardous substances. And again, we decided these based on the historical data we had from the site and our best professional judgment about site types associated with these types of sites. We put them in alphabetical order because it's easier to enter them into the Skidum from Skidum when they're in alphabetical order. That's how they're arranged in Skidum. So you can see we have some metals, arsenic, barium, cadmium, chromium, lead, and selenium. And we have some volatiles, benzene, phenol, I think is slightly volatile. And then we have PAHs, and if you have read through that site information, you'll see that it just says PAHs. So to be conservative, we picked the the most toxic PAH to represent all PAHs that might be there. And that particular substance is benzoylpyrene. We did the same thing for chlorinated solvents, although we really didn't go with the most look at toxicity there. We looked at the most common. So we looked at we decided to use TCE or trichloroethene as our representative chlorinated solvent, and we're going to run our numbers based on those 10 set of contaminants. You also would have seen that we have naturally occurring radioactive materials at the, and those that, which is called norm, we are going to ignore the norm for purposes of scoring. I don't know what's going on there, Sandra. All right, so in order to start adding our substances, first, you either scroll down to your hazardous substance, or you can enter it, start typing it into here, and the program will start taking you to it. But you do want to highlight it, so it should be highlighted in blue. Let me get my cursor here. Highlighted in blue right here. And then you would have to decide, are you going to associate it with the source we're working on, which is the drums, or are you going to associate it with the site as a whole? And in this case, we don't really have much information. We really can't associate it with these contaminants with any single source. So we decided we were going to associate them with the site as a whole. So once you highlight arsenic, you would click the bottom arrow button. And when you do that, you should see arsenic in the box. And then you repeat that process for the other 9 substances until you get them all in the box. And once they are all in the box, then you click the Add Substances button. And when you do that, you get taken back to the sources information screen for the drums.
Therese, I'm sorry. I don't know why it's not popping up. I tested it out, and it was working. I tested it out, and it's not.
Yeah, it just isn't showing up. It's like it's transparent, so you can't see what's on that screen. You can we could just abandon it. I think we could work from this version. I'll just expand my slide so I can see it better. All right, so now we have completed steps 1, 2, 3, and 4 for the drums, and next is step 5. So in step 5, you are deciding whether or not you want this particular source to be used in the soil exposure pathway. And you would check that if the source occurs within the top 2 feet from ground surface. So for this site, we are going to assume that all sources occur within the top 2 feet of ground surface, and we are going to check box the step 5 box for all of our sources. And what this does, once you do that, it assigns that source an AOC letter there at the very far right of the screen. So you can see, for in terms of our sources for our migration pathways, our number one source is drums, and it's also AOCA. And we will use that when we score the soil exposure pathway.
Therese, just before you go any further, I just wanted to confirm. So, Sandra, you're no longer going to show the HRS scoring software anymore?
No, because for some reason it's not popping up when I click on the SCADM button. I don't know why it's not doing that.
Okay, not a problem. Then I'm just going to revert us back to the large layout for the slides.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
So then once you have completed steps 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 for your first source, and it's all in there, you would click the Add the New Source button. And that would take you to a new screen, which gets automatically numbered as number 2 by the program, and then you have to name it. So in this case, we're going to do tanks next. So we type in tanks, we drop down this menu, and we select tanks slash containers other than drums, and that makes this box, step two box, go live and show you the units that you need to use. Now you'll notice, again, we don't have any tier A or B information, so we're really going to look at C and D. And in tier C, we must use our tanks in tier C, but look at the units. I always thought this was a little strange. It wants cubic yards and not gallons. So you need to find out how you convert. And to do that, you could go to Table 2-5. And there's a footnote. So we have, and I'll get to what the footnote says in 1 second. So we have two tanks, and they're 1,000 gallons each. We're going to use tier C volume. We need cubic yards. And there is conversion factors in HRS table 2-5. So the conversion says this. 1 ton equals 2,000 pounds equals 1 cubic yard equals 4 drums equals 200 gallons. So the calculation, you have to convert your 2,000 gallons to cubic yards. So if 2,000 gallons is equal to 1 cubic yard over 200 gallons, you're dividing that 2,000 gallons by 200, and that should give you a value of 10. All right, so then you would enter 10 into the tier C volume right here, and you would click calculate. And it gives you an HWQ of 4 because it is applying the divisor. And the divisor in this case is 2.5. So I always suggest you go back to Table 2-5 or the rule itself. Table 2-5 in the rule will give you all the divisors and check the math that QuickScore is doing just to make sure it's calculating properly. So we know this is calculating properly. It did use the right divisor, and now we can see we have our 4 down here is our HWQ for our tanks. Then we would go, next step would be to check all the boxes. In step 3, we're going to associate the tanks with all 3 migration pathways. Now here's one nice feature. All of our contaminants, because we associated with the site and not the source, have been carried over, and you don't really need to go and add them again. So step 4 is complete, and then the final thing to do is to check the box in step 5, and when you do that, it identifies those tanks as AOCB, as in boy. And once that is done, you would click the Add the New Source button in order to move on to the next source. So the next source we'd want to input is the lagoon. So you would need to type in the word lagoon, and you would need to go to the drop-down menu and select the appropriate surface impoundment description. There are 2 there, a surface impoundment that is not buried and backfilled and surface impoundment that is buried and backfilled. The lagoon is not buried or backfilled. Now, once you've done that, you would go down to step 2. But let's talk a little bit about our lagoon. So what tier should we use for the lagoon? Well, back in that PA information, you would see that we don't know how deep the lagoon is, but its surface area that has been measured. So since we don't have any volume information, we're going to use, if we had volume information, we could use tier C, but instead, since we don't, we're going to use tier D. And the units that are needed for tier D are square feet. And the information we have from the PA is that we have 3,000 square feet for that lagoon. So we go back and we enter 3,000 into the Tier D area box, and we click Calculate, and we get a really fairly high HWQ of 230.76 and a whole bunch of other numbers. Now, the reason this is because the divisor for surface impoundments is fairly low. It doesn't have a huge impact on reducing that 3,000. It's not the case for all source types. So you can also see it brings our lagoon down to the bottom. And as we click these buttons, this information would get filled in. So the next step is step three. Again, you would check all the boxes. We're going to associate the lagoon with all the migration pathways. We have all of our information on contaminants still in place, so we don't have to do anything with step four. And then for step five, we would check that box, and that makes our lagoon our AOC C, as in cat. And then once we're done with that process, we would click the add the new source to go on to our oxidation pond. So you would need to go ahead and, there's a poll. All right, so we have these two surface impoundments located at our site. So here we have a participant true or false question. So all sources with the same source type should be aggregated into one source, even if the wastes are different. Therefore, sources 3 and 4 should be combined. So take a few minutes to think about that, a few seconds actually. Now wait till we get up to at least 50. We're close. All right, here we're at 50 people responding, and you're all doing a great job because the answer to that is false, right? Hazardous substances associated with the source can come from historical information, like permits or manifests or even interviews with us site employees. So you don't absolutely need sampling data in order to decide what sort of hazardous substances are associated with sources. In this case, because we really don't have any information, we're at the PA stage, we are not going to aggregate sources 3 and 4, and we're going to score them separately. So here we're going to enter information on our oxidation ponds. You do have to name it. You also have to drop this down and select surface impoundment, not buried or backfilled. And then we're going to talk a little bit more about our oxidation pond, sorry. So what tier should be used? We could use either C or D. However, we don't have any depth information, so it's very difficult to calculate a volume. Therefore, we're going to use tier D, which is the area. The units that are needed are square feet, and we know from the PA reconnaissance that the lagoon oxidation pond was measured, and it's about 750 square feet. So we take that 750 and we enter it here in the tier D area box. Once you do that, you hit calculate, and its HWQ, or hazardous waste quantity, is 57.69 and a whole bunch of other numbers. That information then lands at the bottom as a summary. And the next step, it's getting a little repetitive, you can see, is to click step three, click all of the migration pathways. Note that step four is already conducted. All those chemicals came and are associated with this, with the site, so you don't have to go and add them all every time. You would want to check the step five box, and that makes our oxidation ponds AOC letter D, as in dog. And then you would click add new source in order for us to do source number five. So source number five is our rubbish pile. So if you were entering this into QuickScore, you would type in rubbish pile. You could call it what you wanted. You would click pile as its source type. And then you would have to decide a little bit more about your pile. So the tier that we would use for our pile would be tier D area. And the units that we need are square feet. Now, if you looked at the footnote in table D, you would note that, and if you are doing a pile and you are looking at 2.5, you should read the D footnote. It's very important to read these footnotes. You would see that it is instructing you to only measure the square feet of the pile in contact with the ground. So you're not trying to measure the area of the surface of the pile, but only that portion of the pile which is in contact with the ground. So that was done during the PA reconnaissance, and that information was provided to you, and that is 500 square feet. So we would put the 500 into the Tier D area box, and then step two would be to hit the calculate button. When you do that, it will calculate your hazardous waste quantity for the pile, which is 38.46, and it would move the rubbish pile down in summary as a source type that you're going to evaluate. Step three, again, check all these boxes for this migration pathways. Note all your contaminants came forward, and then check box five. In order to identify the rubbish pile as an AOC for the soil exposure pathway. And in this case, it gets designated the letter E, as in Edgar. All right, we're almost done. We have one more source to add. So you would click the Add the New Source button, and that would take you, the program would take you to a sort of clean slate. It would identify it as source 6. You would need to type in the description or the source name. We called it stained soil in ditches. And then from the drop-down menu, you identify it as contaminated soil. And you can see, and then let's talk a little bit about our contaminated soil, I think. So the tier that we can use would be area, tier D. The units that we need would be square feet. In the area of the stained soil, we did combine all three of those individual stained soil areas into one 1,000 square foot area. They all look the same, but that is, you know, something of uncertainty to probably note is that can you aggregate that contaminated soil? Is it all the same? So when we go back to our screen, we enter that 1,000 square feet into Tier D area box, and we hit calculate, and we get this tiny little number, 0.0294111. And the reason that is that the divisor for contaminated soil is very large. It is 34,000. So with such a large divisor, it is very hard to get a very high HWQ from contaminated soil. That's just the way it is. The divisor is 34,000, and that and it results in usually very low contaminated soil HWQs, like the one we see right here. All right. So our next steps are to go ahead and click the step three boxes, because we do want the contaminated soil to be looked at for all of the migration pathways. Note that we, again, have all our contaminants coming forward, and then click the box in step five to add one more AOC, our contaminated or stained soil in ditches, and that is going to be designated as AOCF, as in Frank. So then this is a blow-up of the summary at the bottom. And you can see that the two sources that provided the majority of your HWQ points were the lagoon and the oxidation pond. And the pile actually has contributed a fairly significant number. And that's because all of these have fairly low divisors in the HRS rule. And all of these HWQs would be used as you score each of the migration pathways. So the program is going to look back at this information you put in for sources and AOCs, depending on if you're in the migration pathway or the soil exposure pathway. And then you're going to do a little more work on selecting contaminant toxicity and mobility and other characteristics depending on the pathway. And those get combined to give you your WC. So you really don't see the WC yet. You won't see that until you start working with this information in when you're scoring the actual migration pathway or the soil exposure pathway. All right, so I'll summarize and then we'll take questions, Jean. So the objectives of the site scoring process is really to use the HRS Quick Score as a screening tool to calculate your preliminary HRS score. And the overall approach involves calculating our waste quantity or hazardous waste quantity score, and that's what we did today, and that allows us to then use that number in each of the pathways that we score. It'll contribute to the WC. It's only one part, the HWQ is only one part of the WC. The other part has to do with the contaminant characteristics that are evaluated for that particular pathway. Sandra spent some good deal of time appropriately talking about the appropriate use of existing analytical data. The PA guidance cautions you to use existing analytical data with caution. And essentially, you can rule things in quite easily using existing analytical data. It's a little more difficult to rule things out and to say that, you know, we don't really need to look at this anymore based on existing analytical data. The bar is higher for ruling things out. When you're at the PA stage, you're going to have to use best professional judgment because your information is going to be limited. And that doesn't have to be your own personal best professional judgment. You have other resources, you know, at your fingertips, other people maybe with more experience that you could tap into. So don't worry if you're just starting out and you think your best professional judgment is very limited. There are plenty of resources out there for you to turn to, probably within your own organization and certainly with the guidance and fact sheets that EPA publishes. You do need a proper understanding of both the PA and the HRS terminology. If you do take some time to read the PA guidance, it uses a different set of terminology, and that really is because of the way that they used to approach scoring at the PA stage. These days, they would like you to use Quick Score, which is really the full version of HRS, and then use your best professional judgment to address each of the factor values that you have to score, and then use that scratch pad to make notes about what you are really uncertain about and what you are more certain about. And that will help you to design a site inspection that targets the information that you really need to generate the site score. So the HRS Quick Score can be used to calculate pathway and site scores, and we're going to show you more how to do that when we get to the pathways. It's the next module when we start pathways. And you can look at several scenarios very quickly in order to figure out, you know, what piece of information do you need in order to make a significant change in any particular factor value. You can use your best professional judgment to make assumptions and hypotheses that you can then test during your site inspection. And you can design a site inspection that actually tests those hypotheses. All right, that is our the end of our module. Our next module is coming up this Wednesday. It's at the same time, 1 p.m. Central Time. And we will talk about the groundwater migration pathway, and then we will score it using, show you how it's scored using the HIS Quick Score software. So, Jean, I think we could take questions.
I think we can. So for participants, you can continue to submit questions and comments into the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We do have a few that are already in the queue, so I'm going to start with those. But if you're in the middle of typing, don't be afraid. Go ahead and keep typing. We'll get through those ones as well. Our first question asks, do you take into account secondary contaminants when you're determining soil and groundwater pathways?
I'm not sure what they mean by secondary contaminants.
I think if they probably mean maybe degradation products or so, then we would consider those.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. And if that's not what you meant, if you asked the question, feel free to type in an explanation about the phrase secondary contaminants. Okay, our next question. If you find that you've made a mistake after you've completed the HRS, can you go back and make changes by clicking on the, quote, delete source button?
Yes, you can. So you can delete a source and you can add a source.
All right.
You can edit. You can edit anything you've entered into the Quick Score program.
Okay, excellent. And we did have a clarification of that question that we just answered before. It's secondary containment, not secondary contaminants.
So in the so read it again so I can.
I am pulling that.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I have clicked a button, which I hate clicking. So actually, at this exact moment in time, I cannot read all of those questions.
So do you consider secondary containment?
Containment, yes, when you're coming up with your, I believe it was the groundwater and surface water pathways.
Yes, you do consider containment in of the sources in all the pathways.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that in the next upcoming modules.
Okay. So if anybody has any other questions or comments, feel free to type those up into the Q&A window in the lower right-hand corner. While we're giving people just a few extra minutes to type those up, perhaps you guys can just talk again about the software and how they can access it, if it's free to download and install. Just kind of refresh that if you think they should have it available for the next module.
Yeah, I think it would be useful to have it available and maybe play with it a little bit. It can be downloaded from EPA's website. If you just go to www.epa.gov and type in QuickScore as a search, it will take you to that and then select that and you'll see where to download it. So it's a tab that you click. It is free from EPA. You know, if you have corporate security measures, you may need to get permission from an administrator to download it, but it is free software, and it uploads very quickly. You can't break it, so I would encourage you, if you have a chance between now and Wednesday, to maybe go in and play with QuickScore a little bit. There is a LPQ training session in there, so you can see how the LPQ site was scored. And you can also just create a scenario or maybe create an ABC vacuum scenario for yourself and start playing with it. When we do this course face-to-face with, you know, when we're in the room with everyone at least every two people has a computer, and we spend the whole day running the scenario on, and they get to do it on their individual computers as we talk about it. And that's really useful because, you know, they're actually inputting numbers and experiencing all of the little quirks of QuickScore. And we run around and help everybody get on the same page, make sure they have the information in, and then move on. It's a little more difficult to do that in our virtual webinar. But I encourage you to just play around with the program. It's not daunting. I am not a computer genius myself, and I have no trouble using it. So.
Okay. All right. We did have a few other questions that came in. So one of our other participants would like to know what factors determine the magnitude of the divisor that you're using.
I get that question a lot. Those were decided during the first generation of the HRS rule, and they were based on industry findings, but I really can't tell you exactly what how each divisor was derived, but it was derived based on some sort of industry or, you know, survey of what was out there, and there is a method or a explanation behind the divisors.
Okay. And then we have another participant. What would be an example when you wouldn't check on step 5 for the soil exposure pathway?
It would be – oh, go ahead, Sandra. Did you skip, Sandra?
No, I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll answer it. The question was, when would you not check box 5 to associate it with, as an AOC? And I think, you know, you have, if you have a source which is not available to that top 2 feet, so in my mind, it's a potential that the drum source at ABC, which is on a concrete pad, and the tank source at ABC, which is on a concrete pad, might be questionable as being available to the top 2 feet. But it would be for sources that you cannot, you know, sort of with the scientific straight face, associate with the top 2 feet of soil at the site.
Okay. Our next question, do you know if the HRS score developed from QuickScore satisfies ANG-A70R's ERP guidance?
Boy, I do not know if it does.
Okay. And
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. You might want to write in a definition for that acronym. It was ANG, A-N-G, and then the letter A, 70, R's, ERP, ERP guidance. If you can kind of clarify that, we might be able to get an answer for you. If not today, then perhaps offline.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
No, go right ahead.
Oh, see, I would have to call the developers to answer that question myself, so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We also did have a question, if you could please send the map that had all the sources on it so we can try it out for ourselves. And I believe that was the map you all were going through as part of the PowerPoint slide deck. I think that's the map where they're talking about where you were identifying sources.
Yes.
That is indeed the one. I just wanted to remind everybody, these entire slide deck is available to download from the seminar resources page. So I'm going to share that link directly, but you can find that map as well as all of the slides in that packet that we have posted to download. Somebody mentions that it's not on the PowerPoint. So if it's not on there, you guys were only clicking through PowerPoint slides today. Is there another file that's referenced?
I'm not sure what they mean, it's not on the PowerPoint. Didn't we show it on a PowerPoint?
That's what I thought. It was on the PowerPoint. I've got a few people commenting on it. So for the participant that can't find it, I'll go through the deck and I'll pull out the specific slide number that had that map on there.
Yeah, it's slide 3-34.
Yeah.
3-34. Someone's commenting that the PDF version didn't have it. So I'll go in there and double check, and if it wasn't in there, I'll repost it and make sure to email everybody if that map was missing.
Gotcha.
We will get that map to you if it was missing.
Dean, there also is a small handout, I think, that Austin provided that has some information for the PA exercises. It was about 17 or so pages long, and we'll be using that same handout throughout the process.
Okay. All right, thank you. Thank you for clarifying. Again, there's a URL for seminar resources. I'm going to share that with everybody. And on that seminar resources page, you'll find the links to the slides, links to download the QuickScore software, as well as some guidance for the preliminary inspections as well as the assessments, and then the 18 or 17-page scoring exercise document that was just referenced. We have all of that available, so I'm going to share that link with everybody.
And to make the webinar a little easier, Jean, what we've tried to do is to bring all of that information from the PA, essentially, into the slides so people didn't have to keep going back and forth between them.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to do that. So.
Yes. Okay, and then one other question from our participants. Are there any plans to update the 1992 HRS guidance manual?
It's possible. I really don't know if EPA plans to update the guidance. It's possible that if the change in the rule to incorporate vapor intrusion, as I talked about in the very first module, that rule change, proposed rule change, is at OMB. They need to do their 90-day review, and then EPA would propose the change to the rule in the Federal Register. Once that process happens and the rule is finalized, I imagine EPA would possibly update the guidance manual, maybe not a wholesale update, but a new section or a new document that talks about VI. EPA is not putting out a lot of guidance lately, so I wouldn't expect that it would be on their priority list. So.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't see any additional questions coming up in the online queue. So if I'll just start with Sandra, if you have any closing statements for the participants.
No, I'm just sorry that the quick score did not work because we tested it out, and I don't know why the pop-up screens didn't come up.
That's okay. We'll work with you. We'll troubleshoot it. I have the highest confidence we'll get that resolved, and we'll be on board for continued live demonstrations on the next module.
Thank you.
Therese, any other thoughts you'd like to share?
Just don't be afraid of QuickScore. It you can't break it. You can't. You know, it's easy to use, and it's really a nice tool. Get to know HRS and the site assessment process, and then use QuickScore as a tool.
Okay. Well, with that, let me thank you all for joining us, and let's walk everybody through just a few final reminders session. As we noted just a few moments ago, the seminar series is going to carry on this Wednesday with module number 4. The next module will kick off at 1 p.m. Eastern, and we'll take a look at the PA scoring exercises, specifically the groundwater migration pathway. So you should have already registered for that session for July 9th. If you haven't, again, you'll find it on the CLUIN live training calendar, and you can sign up for that session as well. And the whole series will carry on, and we'll conclude with the 9th module on July 30th. For those of you that are interested, we do have a training lookup system for CLUIN. If you visit the following URL, you can actually enter in your email address, and we will automatically send you a table listing every CLUIN webinar that you signed up for and participated using that particular email address that you enter in. So some participants find that to be a really helpful tool to help them keep track of their online training. Remember, it's only going to look up by email address, so if you've used different emails over the course of the year, you may need to enter in different email addresses. If you have problems accessing those email lists, feel free to send me an email at balance.gene@epa.gov, and I'll be more than happy to work with you to pull your training records for you. And then, of course, we will remind everybody, as was mentioned, the seminar slides or handouts, as well as that exercise packet, the PA and the SI documents, and links to download QuickScore are posted on the resources or links page for today's session. Those links are active from this point forward, so if you're actually watching the recorded version of today's webinar, you can also click on those links. You'll find them in the box to the middle right, labeled related URLs. Simply click on the link of interest, which in this case is Seminar Resources, and press the Browse To button to open them up on your own end. We are also asking each participant take a short moment to fill out our online feedback form to let us know what you thought of today's delivery. We'll be asking questions about both the content as well as the mechanism that we use to host today's webinar. Feel free to write in any other comments. Let us know if you had any technical problems or if you thought that the live demonstrations, when we were able to do them, did add something to the training. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can actually hop on and fill their own feedback form out. If there isn't time or you don't have active internet right now, that link to the seminar feedback form can be found found on the seminar homepage. It's also listed under the related URLs pod on the far right. So if you're, again, not able to do it now, want to come back to it later, or you're watching the recorded version, you can still click the link to the seminar feedback form and fill that form out. I highly encourage participants who are looking to track their participation in these sessions to earn credits or earn a training certificate. You will need to participate in all 9 modules. So in order to do so, when you're filling out the feedback form, there is a box you can check. It is circled in red on the slide. If you check that box, you'll be asked to, just check the box off, make sure your email address is entered correctly, and we will send you an automated confirmation email for your own records that does at least verify when you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you take that along with your registration or links to the seminar homepage and materials, that's usually enough to document your participation with your accrediting institution for CEUs or PDHs. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today, other than, again, to just confirm that we did record today's module. So we should be able to post the archive of today's module in about 24 hours, hopefully. You all should receive an automated email once that archive is up. And hopefully we'll all have you back on the line for part 4 on Wednesday, July 9th at 1 p.m. Eastern. My thanks to both of our instructors today, as well as the nearly 130 individuals who signed on to join us for today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's session.